Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, you're listening to the Times Red Box Politics Podcast. I'm Patrick Maguire. Matt Chorley is away all week. He's on the high seas on the Times and Sunday Times literary cruise. And no, that's not a joke. It really exists. So you're with me for the next 6 podcasts. It's great to have your company. And what a great podcast we have for you today. We're talking about British taxes. Are they too high? Will they ever come down? And is this week's Autumn Statement the moment? But first, we're going to speak to Rachel Sylvester and Libby Purvis for today's columnist panel.
The Columnists with Libby Rachey, Libby Purvis and Rachel Sylvester on Times Radio.
Yes, Libby Purvis is here. Hi, Libby.
Hello.
And Rachel Sylvester too. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Patrick.
How are you both? How are you, Libby?
All right. Usual winter, fed up, you know, all that.
I know the feeling. I know the feeling. How are you, Rachel?
I'm very well.
You're less fed up than Libby.
Never fed up.
You're a congenital optimist. That's why we like you on this show. And you have to be optimistic, perhaps, given what's about to happen in the House of Lords this afternoon. David Cameron, Baron Cameron of Chipping Norton, being introduced to the Lords this afternoon. Lord Cameron of Chipping Norton. It's a good one. Libby, what would your territorial designation be? When, not if, you're elevated to the House of Lords?
Well, I don't know why he didn't choose Witnet, really. It's a bit of a snub to his old constituency, isn't it?
It is, isn't it? What do you think? You know, he was obviously the darling of the Chipping Norton set, Rachel.
Yeah, although, interestingly, I just rang up to find out who's going to introduce him.
Oh, yes, because you're flanked by two peers.
You're flanked by two, and he's gone for the establishment. So it's Nick True, Lord True, who's the leader of the Lords, and Baroness Williams, who's the chief whip. So he's gone for the party grandees rather than any friends and mates, which I thought was quite interesting.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, but he does look like a man who will feel comfortable in ermine, doesn't he, David Cameron?
Well, this weekend's papers have been full, as you might have expected this time last week when we were all digesting the appointment, of analysis and reports on his lobbying career, on his business dealings. Rachel, do you think this might be an appointment that was perhaps too clever by half, that might begin to backfire on Rishi Sunak? Or is this all priced in, do you think, the idea that David Cameron has been out and about for 7 years, lobbying, doing whatever? Do you think it's Do you think they'll be nervous in number 10, or do you think they've priced that in?
Well, I think in terms of Britain's reputation abroad, which has been pretty trashed over the last few years, it's probably going to help, actually. Mm. I think he's seen as a serious figure. It's putting foreign affairs to the front of the queue in terms of priorities. He's a big figure. He's a grown-up. He's seen as sensible. I don't think it'll make a huge political difference, to be honest. I'm not sure. I don't think this is what people are voting on. But it was interesting that he's already signalled a shift to the centre by his talk of aid as a moral mission in the White Paper that's out today. So if Rishi Sunak keeps going on that track, I think that's good for him electorally. The problem is he's had so many mixed messages. I think there's an inconsistency there.
What do you think, Libby?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. At first, I thought, yes, I have nothing against Cameron. You know, possibly quite good. I like the little shift towards the centre and so on. But then I thought, last few days, the system, the Lords, the sudden sort of parachuting someone into the Lords, the suddenness of it, the unelected new chap at the very top of government. Somebody, maybe him, should acknowledge that this feels that bit uncomfortable in a democracy. You know, the House of Lords at the moment is full of joke figures put there, not least by Boris Johnson. And it just feels odd that we have to do this manoeuvre and put somebody right into power at the top of government who is not stood for election.
It's striking that the Tories have, you know, 360-odd MPs, Rachel, and the one person, Rishi Sunak, you know, he couldn't even find one prospective foreign secretary among them.
Yeah, it doesn't speak very highly of his own backbenchers, does it? Or frontbenchers, actually, that he can't even find a foreign secretary around his cabinet table. I think I'd rather have people like David Cameron in the House of Lords than these sort of 12-year-old former aides with Boris Johnson who've never done anything, to be honest. And you look back to Lord Carrington, Peter Mandelson during the Gordon Brown years. There is a tradition or a history of putting in senior figures in the Lords doing some of these roles. I agree with Libby that there is a need for Lords reform, but I wouldn't pick this as the fight. I think it's the sort of trashiness of some of the appointees that's more worrying for me.
Well, you mentioned Boris Johnson's number 10, Rachel. Big political story this morning. As we speak, Sir Patrick Vallance, the former chief scientific advisor, is up before the COVID inquiry, talking about the structures of governance or lack of them in Boris Johnson's number 10. Obviously, we've had several weeks now of former advisors to Boris Johnson giving their colleagues a kicking, having their profane WhatsApp thread out. We've had senior politicians, David Cameron, George Osborne, several others up before the inquiry. But do you think, Libby, you know, with a scientist like Patrick Vallance today, we'll actually learn much more than all of the Westminster intrigue and gossip we've had thus far?
Well, I think, I mean, I'm always interested in listening to the scientists because, you know, they deal in absolute facts rather than attitudes or ideas or what will work well with an electorate. I think if they're frank about their doubts and ambiguities, we will learn a lot. But I mean, some of them have already said that the downside, the disadvantages and the long-term damage of lockdowns wasn't part of their brief. You know, that was not what they were supposed to be calculating. That was for politicians, people with a much wider whole sort of PPE, rather than science A-level, science degree level to do. And so, I mean, I'm interested in hearing from them, certainly. And I think when they expose the chaos, as it has been called by Vallance, where the chaos of number 10, I think that is useful to us to know. But it was a limited brief. It was, you know, how many people might get infected, you know, not how can the country survive this in a way which will do least damage to the greatest number of people.
What do you think, Rachel?
I hope that this week we'll have a bit more of a sense of how do we avoid another disaster in future.
And so not sort of blame
not
games.
And WhatsApps and the gossip, really. Mm. Patrick Vallance actually came to talk to our health commission a few weeks ago, and he was so fascinating about how you can't prepare for the next pandemic of a particular kind. You can't re-prepare for the past pandemic. You have to make sure you're investing in the science and the research and the technology that allows you to be fleet of foot and respond to whatever hits you. He says it's a bit like having an army. You're not expecting a war every year, but you have to have those building blocks in place to be ready if something does come. So I think it's that is most interesting from the scientists. What do we do to prepare for another pandemic?
Because that is the point of this. It's easy to forget, given the political gossip, as you say, and that's not to say who hated who in number 10 isn't important, and that it, because obviously it was affecting how the country was run or wasn't. Clearly that was important, but it tends to be sucked into sort of political reporting in that sort of way. You know, but that's what this is meant to be about, Libby, isn't it? Preventing the next pandemic.
Well, yes, and I think we've actually closed down, haven't we? Rachel, you will know, closed down some of our biotechnology abilities and labs. I mean, we need to be investing all the time, and all countries do, and we do especially because we're fairly privileged that way. We need to be investing in just knowing a great deal more about every aspect of health and virology, and that's the only way you can prepare.
Is that the sort of thing you're hearing at the Health Commission, Rachel?
Yeah, the number of clinical trials, for example, has collapsed.
Wow.
And Kate Bingham's absolutely furious that the whole sort of infrastructure that she got in place as head of the vaccine task force just hasn't been upheld. So we're not learning the really important lessons. You know, obviously, it does matter that Downing Street was obviously completely dysfunctional, and that says a lot about the government of that time and Boris Johnson and those around him. But actually, if we're going to avoid another total disaster in future, we have to be prepared in those really hard ways.
Yes,
and also intensive care beds, because our intensive care beds had absolutely slumped. We had fewer per head than anywhere in Europe after Jeremy Hunt was health secretary for years.
And social care, you know, repeatedly politicians have promised to fix social care. I quote Boris Johnson
on the steps of number 10 in 2019.
Yeah, and it's just not happened. And we can't go into another pandemic, which is, you know, the experts say is actually quite likely to happen at some point over the next 5-10 years, with the social care system in such, overrun, impossibly managed.
But Rishi Sunak's currently giving a speech on the long-term decisions he'll take to grow the economy. Let's hear a little bit of it now.
We choose a different path to deliver growth, where we back people and businesses, where the state is there for you during the bad times but gets out of the way during the good, and where the path to prosperity lies not in ever more government intervention, but in creating the conditions for businesses to thrive. And so, to grow the economy, we will take 5 long-term decisions. Reducing debt, cutting tax and rewarding hard work, building domestic sustainable energy, backing British business, and delivering world-class education. The first long-term decision is to reduce our debt, to keep inflation falling and get mortgage rates down to affordable levels. Without financial security, we can't do anything to support families and workers when they need it most. When COVID struck, we could only act because our public finances were in good shape, thanks to the difficult but responsible decisions that were taken over the past decade. Now, I'll always be proud of being the Chancellor who protected 9 million jobs. And in a moment of danger, fear and uncertainty, people turned to this government and did not find us wanting. I'm proud of the support that we've provided to the NHS with record levels of funding. I'm proud, too, of helping households pay their energy bills when Putin cut off the gas. But the only way to give people the peace of mind that government will be there in future crises is to pay down our debts now. And if we don't, we're just leaving our children to pay the bill.
Well, that was Rishi Sunak speaking in London this morning, speaking in North London. The Prime Minister set out 5 long-term promises for the future and his approach to the economy: reducing debt, cutting tax, securing energy, backing British business and world-class education. He went on to say, this is significant ahead of the autumn statement, given what we read in the papers over the weekend, that the time has come to turn our attention to cutting taxes. Over time, we can and will cut taxes, he said. Rachel, there was a lot in there. What do you make of the politics of all of this?
I think it depends on which taxes they decide to cut and when and how. And the judgment will be who benefits. So if they go ahead with inheritance tax cuts, for example, while also reducing benefits in real terms, that won't be seen as a fair choice. But if they go for tax cuts that help businesses or help, the lower income families, that's a different choice. The problem is, if you're prioritising tax cuts over investment in public services, everything's a choice and it means not doing other things.
Libby, do you think the government will get the credit for cutting taxes at a time of, you know, inflation has halved, but it's still relatively high, higher than most people who have known it, have ever known? Are they like to get any credit for cutting taxes, do you think?
Well, it's the matter of which taxes, as Rachel says. But, I mean, there are other things which are far more urgent, like unfreeze housing benefit. Massive numbers of people. I was listening this morning to another report. Massive numbers of people have been thrown out under Section 28, you know, eviction orders, families out. Terrific housing problem, terrific homelessness problem. And housing benefit has been frozen for quite a while now. And councils are begging for it to be unfrozen again. So there are far more sort of serious things than mid-range and inheritance tax cuts. You know, that just seems like sort of faffing around with the marshmallows, you know, when the cake is collapsing underneath.
And it's another sort of five pledges as well for Rishi Sunak, Rachel. You know, we had the five pledge at the start of this year. We've got now five new economic pledges, it seems. We had his conference speech, which said he was going to be the change candidate. And this now seems to be back on a trust me to deliver message. It's sort of yet another, not quite a relaunch, but it's another new message from a number 10 that struggled, I think it's fair to say, to pick one line and stick to it.
I was really pleased that education was in his new five-point plan, actually, because it's been so sidelined by politicians over the last almost decade, actually, as a major issue. And it's good that Rishi Sunak has put that into a sort of growth package rather than just a public service reform package, because it is. You're never going to get the economy back up and running, the country back on track, productivity, unless you make an education system that kind of links to the jobs and the companies need.
And it's something the Prime Minister really believes in, particularly the investment in skills education and broadening the curriculum that way. You know, he's long called it a silver bullet, you know, and obviously lifted a lot of the Times Education Commission's proposals wholesale, didn't he?
Well, and I thought it was very interesting. One of the sort of under-noticed bits of the reshuffle was Nick Gibb, who was the long-standing schools minister, leaving. A lot of people in Whitehorse say that he's been blocking some of the reforms that Rishi Sunak may have wanted to push through, particularly on assessment and curriculum reform, because he's got this very kind of narrow traditional view. So, I mean, he's running out of time, Rishi Sunak, but at least there is a kind of potential legacy there, which ought to be with cross-party agreement, I think, that this the education system shouldn't be something that's a political football, that you could have a kind of long-term reform there.
Do you agree, you know, we talk of a Rishi Sunak legacy, Libby, is that the territory we're in now? You know, any announcement the Prime Minister makes is about securing a legacy rather than shifting the dial electorally?
Well, if he can push anything the right way for the country, you know, like that, like this education reform and so on, if he can set a ball rolling the right way, which is not going to be immediately rolled back by Keir Starmer, and actually Keir Starmer's a sensible guy and probably wouldn't roll back anything that was sensible. Yes, I mean, he's doing the job for the moment. We're paying him to do the job for the moment. Let him do some things which might work. And the less, I mean, just stop fussing about the Rwanda plan, but that's another issue.
It is indeed another issue. A fifth of teachers, let's stick with education and discuss the story I was talking about just before we took a break earlier. A fifth of teachers centering their lessons to avoid potentially causing offence over issues surrounding race, gender and sexuality, a survey from the IPPPR think tank has found. What do you think of this, Rachel? Have you picked this up in your conversations with teachers before?
I definitely think there is an anxiety about the culture wars that have hit education. So I talked to Rachel D'Souza, the Children's Commissioner, recently for the Health Commission, actually, and she was highlighting the huge rise in sexually transmitted infections, particularly among
school children.
School children.
Wow.
Yeah, teenagers and young people. And she said she's blaming the kind of culture war over sex education. So she says because children aren't being taught the basics, because schools and teachers are so worried about what they're allowed to say about gender, about sex, it's part of the same thing. There's a kind of anxiety about getting it wrong. And the government has still not produced its guidance for schools on sex education. So Rachel D'Souza is saying children aren't being taught the basics. They're learning their sex education from TikTok. And the result is they don't know how to behave safely. They don't know how to sort of ensure they're respected. And you've got this huge rise in STIs.
Wow. What do you think, Libby?
It is unbelievable that children are not being taught the absolutely boring biological basics and health basics at school. I mean, here you could throw the whole gender ideology stuff right out. I think one of the shocking things, as Rachel says, there's no national policy, is that schools are so scared of all this, they are outsourcing it to ridiculous companies which have a terrific sort of extreme culture war agenda about trans. They are outsourcing it to these schools who provide these materials, and parents have to fight to see the materials because of this excuse about commercial confidentiality. Parents have to fight for that. So it is absurd. And, I mean, teachers are always just being shoved on the front line. And the Batley case was absolutely shocking.
That was the teacher who showed his class a cartoon of Prophet Muhammad.
The Charlie Hebdo thing, and is still in hiding, I believe. You know, so the whole thing is atrocious. And the government, if it is state education, the state is in charge of it, and the state should be stepping up and paying some proper attention to things which are causing this kind of trouble.
What can be done, do you think, Rachel? Do you think it's incumbent on politicians, before you talked about education being used in political football, do you think it's incumbent on politicians not to wade in so aggressively, perhaps, as they have been on this issue? Or is it just these issues are so knotty and so difficult that inevitably some teachers, some schools are going to blink in the headlights?
I actually think on the curriculum, it ought to be done by a kind of independent panel. So on the Education Commission, we said have a review with, and you'd have businesses involved, you'd have scientists, you'd have health leaders, you could have, you know, local politicians or, you know, local civic leaders as well. So it shouldn't be a political football that's sort of part of the culture war. It should be what is right for children, what does the country need children to learn, what do children need to learn for their own safety and, you know, wisdom, rather than this sort of constant ding-dong political back and forth.
That was Libby Purvis and Rachel Sylvester there. Remember, you can read them in The Times every week. Just head to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox to get yourself a digital subscription or pick up a copy of the paper wherever you get yours from. Coming up, we're talking tax.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
You're listening to the Red Box podcast. Now it's time for this.
The Big Thing on Times Radio.
We need to have a lower tax burden, actually, than we've got now. And we believe that because if you look around the world, the fastest growing parts of the world are places like North America and Asia, where they do generally have lower tax burden.
We are taxed more than we have been at any point for the last at least 70 years. So by UK historic standards, we are very highly taxed, and taxes have gone up, as I said, a lot over this parliament. But relative to most of Western Europe, we are less highly taxed. I mean, taxes in France, for example, are massively higher.
That was the Chancellor Jeremy Hunt speaking to Times Radio yesterday about the need for tax cuts, and the Director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies, Paul Johnson, giving me his take on how much tax we pay in the UK. Now, with speculation about tax cuts running fairly wild ahead of Wednesday's autumn statement, in today's big thing, we're going to try to get to the bottom of this murkiest of debates. Just how much tax are we paying, and what, if anything, can the Chancellor do about it this week? We're going to hear from Low Tax Florida in the US. We'll hear from a Tory MP arguing for the Chancellor to take some action. But first, let's talk about what we're paying at the moment with Joanna Noble, money editor at The Times and Sunday Times. Hi, Joanna.
Hiya.
As Paul Johnson just said, tax burden in the UK is incredibly high at the moment, historically high. So what are the obvious targets for a Conservative Chancellor who wants to cut taxes to look at?
Well, many feel like they are being taxed left, right and centre, and I'm not surprised. I mean, income tax thresholds have not increased since April 2021, and they are planned to stay frozen until April 2028. And we also have the amount you can earn tax-free has remained static at 12,570. Now, we heard that the Chancellor are considering looking at income tax. So there are two ideas that are floated at the moment. One is to reduce the headline rates of income tax and national insurance. And the other one is to up tax threshold. Looking at the latest this morning, it looks like a national insurance cut is most likely to be in the cards, since it's more expensive to look at income tax.
And The Times has launched a campaign against stealth taxes. Now, you were talking there about income tax thresholds being frozen, which That's obviously, right. as inflation rises, as wages rise with inflation, if you're lucky enough to get a pay rise in line with inflation, people are dragged into higher tax bands. Just why is this so much of an issue, Joanna?
Well, as I said, income tax thresholds haven't increased since April 2021. And last year, more than 6 million people paid income tax at 40% of earnings, up from 4.3 million in 2019. And if it continues, it's predicted that by 2028, 7.8 million people will be higher rate taxpayers. And that would include 1 in 8 nurses, 1 in 5 electricians, and 1 in 4 teachers, all caught out by a tax originally intended for the wealthy. And The Times is calling for the government to put an end to these stealth taxes. We want to increase the income tax threshold. Nurses should not be penalised with higher income tax unless they are getting a mighty pay rise, which we all know is probably not likely. And we're also calling on them to soften the 100,000 cliff edge. It's madness that going £1 over this 100,000 threshold could end up costing a family £10,000.
Wow.
And we also want the Chancellor to look at doing something to help savers. So we wanted to raise the personal savings allowance. It was originally promised that most savers, I think they said 95%, wouldn't breach it, but were savings rates much more competitive. Many are now forced to pay tax on the savings, and that's money that had already been taxed on once.
Now, Joanna, you grew up in Sweden. And obviously, for some people in the UK and across the world, the Nordic countries are seen as a sort of social democratic paradise, a utopia for people of that political persuasion. Taxes are much higher there, but that goes hand in hand with a generous benefit system. Now, is that an oversimplification? How, you know, it's often said as well that if Britain wants Nordic style social services and public services, it has to have Nordic style taxes. But just how popular is that sort of model in Sweden? Is it still as popular as it has been?
I mean, the tax system both here and in Sweden are incredibly complex. So it's really hard to make direct comparisons. But just to sort of simplify it a little bit in Sweden, so vast majority sort of the regular taxes around 30, 32%. And if you're a higher earner, you can pay 50% above a certain threshold. And the feeling amongst many Swedes is that they do get value for money, though. So, for example, childcare is subsidized. So if you send a child to nursery in Sweden, regardless of your salary, you wouldn't pay more than about sort of £120 a month per child. And you get more of a discount if you got more than one child. Here in Britain, as we know, a lot of parents of preschoolers are having to fork out sort of a similar amount to what they pay for the mortgage every month to pay for childcare. So it's a massive difference. Should Britain take a leaf out of Sweden's book? I mean, I don't think it's as straightforward as that. Politicians have the job of making the balance between what the state can offer and how much tax they will levy. And getting that balance right is not easy. And I don't envy the Chancellor, to be honest.
Well, Joanna Noble, money editor at The Times and Sunday Times, you've got a much better job than being Chancellor. All of the influence, but none of the tough decisions that the Chancellor is going to be taking. Thanks very much for talking us through where the Chancellor might find space to cut taxes in the autumn statement, and also whether Sweden, very high tax country, is a model for the UK. Not as simple as some on the left may think, says Joanna. We've talked about Sweden then, but the place increasingly cited by thinkers on the right of politics as a low tax paradise isn't one of the conventional tax havens of the public imagination. It's not Switzerland or Jersey or the Cayman Island. It's Florida. Jackie Goddard, Times correspondent based in Miami, says the grass isn't always greener, though.
Britons may think of Florida as a paradise, and it definitely has its high points. Of course, the beaches, the waving palm trees, Walt Disney World, the nice weather in spring and winter at least. Forget the hurricanes and the humidity for the rest of the year. But that's the Florida maybe that you remember from your holidays. And actually living here comes with some economic pitfalls. I think folks looking to flee here for economic reasons need to know that the grass is not always greener. Sure, Florida does not have state income tax. That sounds good, right? And nor do a number of other states, actually, in the US. And that's definitely a bonus. But it does have, in Florida, a 7% sales tax on everything but food. So factor that in. The cost of living here is notoriously high. Salary.com will tell you, Orlando, for example, the cost of living there is nearly 5% higher than the national average. Miami and Fort Lauderdale around 14% higher than the national average. And Sarasota over on the lovely Gulf Coast of Florida, 8% higher. The inflation rate in Florida is higher than the national average. It hit 7.4% in October for the Miami, Fort Lauderdale and West Palm region. That's a very popular area for living. And that's more than twice the nation's rate. And much of that is due to the steep cost of housing. There's a housing crisis here in Florida. Rent and house prices are out of control. Folks cannot afford to buy or rent a property. Housing costs in the region are 12% higher than a year ago. Nor can a lot of people afford the insurance. Remember here, this is a hurricane zone. And there have been increasing number of major hurricanes in the last few years, which have cost the industry greatly. And as a result, some areas of the insurance industry are pulling out of Florida, which puts more pressure on those providers that are here. So they rack up the prices. And of course, that impacts on people. There are property taxes. The exchange rate is horrible. There is medical insurance and utility costs are up. Remember that for all that lovely weather we get, you've got to run your air conditioner and that's going to cost you more too. During the COVID pandemic, a lot of people moved into Florida, and that growth in population is one of the key reasons for inflation being pushed up significantly too, and costs, especially housing, soaring. One other thing to mention, of course, is medical insurance. You will pay thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands to insure yourself and your family so that if you need medical care here, you can even get it, and that will cost you dearly. Again, the market has become very mixed up in the last few years, and I think certainly living in America makes you very grateful for the free healthcare system in the UK.
Well, that was Times correspondent in Florida, Jackie Goddard. It was reported last week that lots of wealthy Britons were looking to move to Florida because they were frightened of what a Labour government might mean for their tax bills. Indeed, Rishi Sunak said this morning that handing economic management to Labour would be just as dangerous as Liz Truss crashing the markets. But if that applies to you, if you're looking for a safe haven, Jackie Goddard there with a warning that Florida isn't perhaps the low-tax utopia it may seem. But what do Conservative MPs want? Well, let's bring in one of them now. John Stevenson is chair of the Northern Research Group of Conservative MPs. He joins me now. Hi, John.
Good morning.
So what do you want then? The Chancellor is making lots of encouraging noises for those among you who want tax cuts. Indeed, Rishi Sunak has said now is the moment for tax cuts in that speech in North London this morning. So what taxes would you like to see them cut?
Well, I think there's a number of things to say right from the start. First of all, you need to have fiscal stability. You've got to know that the finances of the nation are in good shape, first and foremost. Then secondly, we've got to have policies that will bring about growth in the economy, because at the end of the day, it's growing the economy that's the most important thing of all. And how we go about that is what I think the Chancellor should be concentrating on. But when it comes to the specifics of tax, I think it's a direction of travel that I think all of us want to see. And I think when we come to the next election, there'll be a clear divide between ourselves and the Labour Party as to the direction of travel. What I would like to see personally, and I think most of my Northern colleagues would like to see, is a concentration on either the business taxes, whether it be about rates or full deduction, or personal taxes, but around income tax and thresholds, rather than seeing any reduction in inheritance tax or capital gains tax. So I think it's about direction of travel on the back of financial stability, and it's about concentrating on those tax cuts that will benefit and grow the economy.
And also, the sorts of people who voted Conservative for the first time in 2019 are now having second thoughts, I imagine, John. You want to be able to say to them, look, this is a government that's cutting taxes for hardworking people like you who are struggling with the cost of living crisis, and not, for instance, as you say, inheritance tax and capital gains tax, which a lot of people don't pay, will never pay, and have very certain views of the people who do pay them.
Absolutely. But I also think these sort of people understand making sure that we have financial stability as well, and making sure that the books are going in the right direction. But what they want also is to make sure that they've got more money in their own pockets, and they can make the decisions that they want to about what they spend their money on and what they do with their families. And I think that's absolutely right. I think individuals are better at making those decisions than governments are. So the direction of travel, I think, is really important, that people realise that the Conservatives are on their side, that do want to reduce the tax burden. We've also got to make sure that we have our growing economy as well. I think we've done a fantastic job over the last 12, 13 years on unemployment. We have very low unemployment rate. We finally started to see inflation coming down significantly. And the difference between inflation and what people are getting paid, there's starting to be a gap. And I think that's a positive thing that's happening, which means that people's standard of living should be starting to rise. And if you combine that with a small tax cut, I think people will start to feel better and feel that the Conservative government and the Conservative Party are actually on their side.
Some people might say, John, that this looks a little bit desperate from the Prime Minister and the Chancellor. They've spent so long, as you say, talking about fiscal responsibility. The Prime Minister lost the first leadership election because he was warning against tax cuts from Liz Truss. They didn't go particularly well, and it's barely been a year and now they're rushing to cut taxes, having for a very long time talked about now not being the moment for tax cuts. You know, do you accept that some people will think this is sort of cynical electioneering that's chucking away all the arguments the government has made so far?
No, because if you take the first point, I think the market's demonstrated that you do actually have to have financial stability. And I think people recognise that that is an important foundation for building a strong economy and improving the, reducing the tax burden. But then looking forward, we have always been traditionally a party of lower tax. We want to see that agenda return to the forefront of our economic policy. That is the direction of travel that the government is taking us in, one that I welcome, and as do my colleagues. I think it will be a clear dividing line at the next general election. But at the end of the day, what do we really want? We want a growing economy, we want people to have employment, and we want people to have money in their pocket that they can make the decisions that they want to about what they spend their own money on.
The Prime Minister this morning said it would be the same mistake as the mini budget, this Truss's mini budget that we've been talking about, to trust Rachel Reeves and Starmer, Keir Starmer, as the with the economy, and he says they'd be just as dangerous. Who's going to believe that? Clearly, clearly nobody thinks that these are sort of crypto Corbynites at the top of the Labour Party, because they're currently polling, 20 points ahead of you.
Well, we'll have to wait and see what they come up with for their election manifesto. But they criticise the government not spending enough money on this, that and the next thing. Where's that money going to come from, other than increasing taxation? Traditionally, everybody knows the Labour Party can't help themselves when it comes to taxation. They always want to increase it because they always want to spend more money. They're not prudent. They always think the state knows better than the individual. And I think as you approach an election, when people actually have to think about what the decision that they're going to make at the ballot box is all about, they'll start to think, hang on, the Conservatives want to reduce my tax burden. They want to put more money in my pocket, in contrast to what the Labour Party want to do. And right now, from a political perspective, it's more of a referendum on the government. And I understand that people are a little bit frustrated by things. But come a general election, it becomes a choice. It's a decision, which party do you want to be in government and what policies are they going to be pursuing? And I just think when it comes to that decision that will be made later next year, I think people think, well, this is what the Conservatives are offering. This is a danger for Labour. Why won't I stick with the Conservatives?
We're talking about the tax burden in the UK and whether the Chancellor and the Prime Minister are right that taxes now need to come down, or whether, if you're looking at some of the problems the country is facing, perhaps it's time for them to go up instead. Well, I'm joined by an expert panel now to ponder those questions. Rachel Henry is Head of Advocacy and Policy at Tax Justice UK. Hi, Rachel.
Hello, Patrick.
And Julian Jessop, Economics Fellow at the Institute of Economic Affairs. Hi, Julian.
Hello, good morning.
Rachel, I'll start with you. When you hear the Prime Minister today talk about now being the moment to turn our attention to tax cuts, you'll have heard John Stevenson, the Conservative MP for Carlisle and chairman of the Northern Research Group there, talking about his desire to see taxes come down. The Chancellor has been making noises to that effect over the weekend. Clearly, there's a groundswell of appetite for this in the Conservative Party. Are they right?
Well, I think the groundswell of support is, like you say, in the Conservative Party. And, you know, this is mainly in Westminster. If you look across polls, what people are actually concerned about is the state of public services. People want to be able to get a GP appointment. They want to be able to go to the hospital without waiting 14 hours in A&E. They want to be able to send their children to school without fear that, you know, the building is literally going to crumble around them. You know, what people are really, really concerned about is the state of public services. So if there is any headroom in the finances, it should absolutely be going towards funding higher quality public services.
What do you say to that, Julian?
Well, I think it's not just a choice between cutting taxes or investing in public services. I genuinely believe that you can do both. What you need to do is to grow the economy, to increase tax revenues to pay for those services. But you don't do that by continually raising tax rates and even creating new taxes that simply hold the economy back. So I think you can actually increase investment in public services at the same time as cutting taxes. The alternative of raising taxes, I think, would simply create an even worse doom loop than we're in at the moment. So, you know, the economy is weak, public finances are deteriorating. That requires higher taxes and feeds back into even weaker growth. So I don't think that's the way ahead either.
Cutting taxes and increasing investment sounds a bit like Trussonomics, Julian. Haven't we tried that already to disastrous effect?
Well, actually, I think the overall strategy adopted by Liz Truss was correct. The problem was how it was done. It was done too quickly. It was poorly communicated. But if you look at a lot of the ideas that she was talking about, for example, cutting business taxes to boost investment, that is now something that the government is taking seriously again. Remember that she cancelled the increases in national insurance, and that probably was an important factor preventing the recession that many people feared by now. So I think the overall strategy of Liz Truss was correct, but obviously the delivery, the presentation, the communication was terrible.
Got a text here from listener David in Croydon that I wanted to put to you both. He says, if you're discussing tax rates in the UK, you're looking at it the wrong way. Much more relevant is who isn't paying, not the rate. Many high earners work in London but live abroad to avoid UK tax. Meanwhile, corporations such as Amazon and Starbucks export their profits to avoid UK tax. Those paying in the UK are overpaying to fund those not paying. It's quite the text there from David in Croydon. Rachel, what do you think?
I'm very much in agreement with David in Croydon. I think often when we talk about increases in taxes, we wrongly only think about it as being increases on working people. And I'm very sympathetic that, you know, at a time of cost of living crisis, we shouldn't be looking to raise taxes on working people. But there are many very wealthy people and multinational companies in the UK that don't pay a fair rate of tax at the moment. You know, Amazon last year, because of a, you know, tax break from the government and, you know, also, you know, profit shifting and things like that, you know, they paid, you know, no tax on one of their sort of, you know, divisions of their UK division. You know, there's other big multinationals that don't pay enough tax, and there's very wealthy people in the UK that don't pay enough tax. For example, our Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is lucky enough to be one of the wealthiest, rich 250 wealthiest people in the UK. He pays a lower rate of tax than a nurse. That's because capital gains tax is set at around 20% compared to income tax at 40%. So I believe that, you know, there's wealthy people in the UK that could be taxed more. I'd like to just, if I can briefly, though, just address one point on growth. I think that the UK at the moment is, according to the Institute for Government, stuck in a doom loop, really. You know, we have not invested enough in public services for too long. And this is leading to short-sighted policies that in the end cost more. This is also impacting economic growth. So you can see that we have 8 million people on the NHS waiting list at the moment. That is no good for businesses who need fit and healthy people to be able to work. We have problems with human capital because we don't, you know, invest well enough in training and vocational training and all of those sorts of things. And we have a really unproductive housing stock that also means, you know, energy costs are much higher. And that means that business costs are higher because, you know, businesses have, you know, unproductive sort of offices that cost them a lot to heat. All of these sorts of things are driven by not enough public investment. So I'm in agreement with John. We definitely want, you know, growth, but I don't think we're going to get there by lowering taxes. The way to get there is by smart public investment that will help crowd in business investment.
Is she right, Julian?
I think she's partly right, actually. I think we do need to invest more in infrastructure, and some of that money should come from the public sector. So we have big problems with things like transport, energy, poor quality hospitals and school buildings and so on. I'd actually be quite sympathetic to the idea of raising public sector investment from about 1.5% of national income now to about 3%. But it's perfectly reasonable to borrow to do that rather than to fund that by raising taxes now. Provided you balance the rest of the budget, then you could invest, say, 3% of national income and still have debt falling as a share of national income, which is what we really want. If we're looking at public services more generally, though, I think it's wrong to say that the only way to improve them is to spend more money on them. If we take the NHS as an example, we injected an enormous amount of cash into the NHS over the last few years. It's employing more doctors and more nurses than ever, but it's still actually treating fewer patients than it was before the pandemic. And the reason is the huge problem here of productivity in the public sector has basically been flat for as long as we can remember. So I would actually prioritise fixing the productivity problem, which may require some investment in things like IT and buildings in some cases. But I wouldn't do that by ramping up taxes on the rest of the economy and just making the growth outlook even worse.
Well, thank you very much, guys. Really interesting discussion. Rachel Henry, Head of Advocacy and Policy at Tax Justice UK, and Julian Jessop, Economics Fellow at the Institute for Economic Affairs. Loads and loads of you getting in touch about this one today. We have John on the text, says inheritance taxes, tax on funds that have already been taxed. The rich don't pay tax because they can manage their investments and receive advice. It's those like me who have worked hard, taken risks, been successful and prudent, and are financially secure. I can fund my retirement and leave something for my children. However, because of inheritance tax, I will distribute savings early, which will increase the risk that I may eventually need state support. Inheritance tax is immoral and causes people to make the wrong decisions. David in Croydon, again, he at least apologises for his many texts this morning. If businesses or individuals avoid tax, it doesn't matter what the rate is. Anonymous texter says, we invest more than enough in public services, but it all goes into pensions. Andy Wilson got in touch in Twitter regarding tax cuts. How are we now paying for the social care that was going to be funded by the national insurance rise, which was reversed by Liz Truss? Is this now fully funded by tax? If not, how can there be any money available for tax cuts? Lots of really interesting questions for the Chancellor to consider on Wednesday, although these decisions, of course, have already been taken in consultation with the Office for Budget Responsibility. So, no matter how interesting that discussion was, the Treasury aren't going to change their mind. And, you know, I heard a lot of interesting cases there. For tax cuts, against tax cuts, for a high tax model, for a low tax model. It seems that Britain is caught between all of those rocks and hard places at the moment, with the highest tax burden on record. That's all we got time for on today's podcast. I'll be back tomorrow. But in the meantime, make sure you like, share, subscribe and follow wherever you get yours from.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.